Welcome again to this retreat, which is the number 5 Profound Treasury retreat here at Fairy Beach. And I feel so warm and fuzzy to be here with all of you, and so appreciative and grateful to have this opportunity to practice and study the Dharma together. And I think there are many possible things one could do. And this is, of the many possible things one could do, this is really a pretty good one. It's a way to connect with the wisdom and the traditions of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who I'll refer to as the Vidyadhara. And in particular, to connect with the series of teachings based on stages of the path, the three main stages of the path, the Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the Vajrayana, all called vehicles or yanas. And the amazing thing about these three yana teachings is they provide a way to work with our lives, many different strategies and many different levels. And they provide a map to be able to move forward on our journey. That's why they're called vehicles. They're like ways to move along in our practice, our study, and our general life and awakening. So this description or the idea of stages of the path or Lam Rim teachings was pretty important, it seemingly, to Trungpa Rinpoche, because he spent between 2 and 3 months every year teaching in the form of three yana teachings, talking about different aspects of each of those vehicles. And that is what makes up the three volumes of the Profound Treasury. And the inspiration isn't just nostalgia for those series of teachings, but recognizing their value and transformative potential is what I think inspired a lot of the founders of this retreat to try to present it to others and, as much as possible, give it away to people who can take it on and realize it in their lives and share it with people who might benefit from all that. So that's a little bit by way of background. And traditionally, when one starts to study and practice, the starting point is to reflect on your why you're here, your inspiration, and to rouse the mind of awakening and compassion, the tendency to grow and awaken in life is called bodhicitta. To rouse bodhicitta, to think of the way beyond the walls of your body, the walls of this room, the walls of Maine, if there were walls. And we know a lot about walls lately. But to break down the walls and kind of picture oneself within the context of all it is, which, of course, is really a central theme we'll be exploring in terms of mandala. So today, I wanted to just make some introductory remarks. And these teachings will not be, they're not designed as scholarly or intellectual particularly. They're designed for people who are practitioners and who want to integrate the teachings into their being in some way. So inspired to study wholeheartedly and complement that with practice and with a sense of community that is formed here. Trungpa Rinpoche taught a lot about mandala and mandala principle from early on. He gave 2 major seminars at Karma Choling, and one was called The Mandala of Unconditioned Energy, and that was early, 1972, In 1974, he did the teachings called the Mandala of the Five Buddha Families. And of course, he touched on a mandala principle very deeply within the context of the Profound Treasury. So some of those teachings are found in Profound Treasury. Some are found in this book called Orderly Chaos. But if you explore the Vajrayana path in any degree, whether as a view that would affect how you do your path, whether you drawn to more Hinayana, Mahayana side of things, or whether you're a Vajrayana practitioner itself, the mandala principle is everywhere. It is so important to understand what you're doing if you're going to do Vajrayana practice. And I appreciate the fact that Trungpa Rinpoche put such emphasis on understanding what are the building blocks of this teachings and how does it progress over the three yanas. He gave a seminar, another seminar called the Mandala Principle in the Three Yanas, which is not published material, but that's another source because he saw it as bridging all three yanas as well as being a Vajrayana concept. So I was reflecting that every morning we chant, and we're exploring that as a practice, etc. But one thing we chant is the four dharmas of Gampopa, and the line that says, grant your blessing so that confusion may dawn as wisdom. That is what the mandala principle is all about. And we also do a chant with a line, grant your blessing so that I may realize the inseparability of samsara and nirvana, which is also very much linked to what we'll be exploring as a mandala principle. What we're exploring, in other words, is some kind of transmutation and looking into how to deal with the energies of life, the inner world, the outer world, and the vast cosmos, I suppose you could say. So I thought I'd talk about what is a mandala? Or as often I run into in my life, mandala. What is a mandala? It's many things. So I want to talk a little bit just about the term and the basic definitions as we move forward. So mandala is a catch-all term. It can mean a society or a group or a circle, you know, like you have a circle of friends or you have a society of this or that. It's used very in ordinary language in Asia. You have a club. You can be called a mandala, the soccer mandala or the, I don't know, crocheting mandala or the this or that. So it has a sense of a community organization. A mandala also is used, obviously, for the various arts of expressing teachings in the form of paintings or arrangements of objects or design of various kind. There's probably people most familiar in general day-to-day life, they think mandala, they think of art, you know, a picture that comes from Tibet. And that is one thing that it is. Traditionally, mandalas are created by painting or by creating three-dimensional structures or by sand, you know, which is done both in the indigenous tradition here as well as the Tibetan tradition. And other ways, it personified, it expresses something. Also, the mandala in the Vajrayana is a practice that people do. A mandala represents the entire, more than world, cosmos. It represents everything, kind of If you imagine, you know, people are always talking about, well, not some people, cosmos, universe, world. If you think about, it's hard to think about everything. Nothing is not within a mandala. There is no outside. It's everything. It represents everything. And in a preliminary practice in Tibetan Buddhism and other contexts, people offer the mandala, which means offering everything, not just so-called your things, but everything. So a sense of generosity, opening, and offering is mandala is used in that sense as well. And a mandala is dynamic. It is not a static thing. So the idea of a wheel, a mandala is like a wheel that rotates and turns and generates energy. And by that turning, delusions are transformed into wisdom. So an interesting parallel, because samsara, or the world of confusion, is also described as something turning round and round. So it's kind of the mirror image of that typical description of samsara. The Tibetan term, Kyokor, K-Y-I-L-K-H-O-R, is a term for mandala that the Vidyadhara used often, and it simply means center, fringe. Something has a center and a fringe. You know, like a circle has a center and a perimeter. Center, fringe. And we'll talk over the course of our discussions, we'll talk about various definitions of mandala that will kind of enrich and deepen one's understanding of what it's all about. Another way that Trungpa Rinpoche referred to mandala, as in the title of his book, he referred to it as ordinary chaos. Orderly chaos, sorry. Orderly chaos. I thought that sounded wrong. Orderly chaos. So that's an interesting thought. You know, there's chaos and there's orderly. He said the mandala is orderly chaos. Orderly chaos. It's almost like when they discovered fractals, you know, that seem to be chaotic natural patterns. When they actually looked into them, they saw there's some kind of order happening. So orderly chaos. Another thing, in terms of exploring mandala, is that it's points to kind of a vast system of interconnectedness. And one can think of confusion or wisdom or have some vague notion of confusion versus wisdom. But in the teachings of the mandala principle, it breaks those things down. It makes them very precise. What do you mean by neurosis, by chaos? What do you mean by wisdom? And what is the relationship between the two? And how does that relationship change as we make acquaintance? Does that relationship change how we view confusion, how we view wisdom? Because a lot of times I think we think we're, you know, trying to get from somewhere, go from some place to another place. And we are in some ways. But there is no place to go from the mandala principle. We're already there. But we'll get into that more. A little bit. So I wanted to introduce a fair number of terms today, so hopefully you can be patient about that, but they will help as we move forward. But before we do that, I wanted to pause for a moment. Another thing that mandala is about, very much so, is perception, how we perceive our world. You know, there's a phrase, a fog of war, and this is we could be thinking of exploring what is a fog of ego. The fog of ego. How? What does it mean? What is being looked at? How do we view what we're doing at the most basic level of what our immediate experience? So, I would like you to spend a moment just noticing your experience. What is coming in to your experience in what ways? Just to explore that. You know, how do you know you're even here? You know, what is the here anyway? Notice looking inward to whatever is going on within your mind, feelings, body. And notice outward, the world is called the world of projections, the environment around you. You can look around. You don't have to be all solemn and tight. You can look around and, you know, explore with your mind or other senses something, some sense of feeling that you're somewhere, that you're aimed in a certain direction, and that various perceptions are coming into you. And for every single one of you, it'd be different. You're in a different location, if nothing else. We don't really think about it that much. The having a location, having a perspective. And certain obvious things pop up. There are many, many colors. Look at all the colors. All the colors. There's kind of perception of different kinds of energies, internal and external feelings of energy. There's perception of whatever mood or imagery that's arising in our minds. There's sounds, there's things coming in through the sense perceptions. And for most of us, there's a lot of arising of commentary on all of that. Instant commentary on all of it. Our thoughts about things, our judgments about things, our ideas of what we'd like to have happening, and why doesn't she go down with the talk and all that. a sense of perception of passage of time and expectations, sense of wanting to go forward in some way or wanting to make something happen or stop something from happening. Thoughts of how we think things should be. So how we perceive things, you know, is very much colored by all sorts of our histories, our prejudices, our biases, our preconceptions. If you look within, you'll see a lot of them, if you're like me, anyway. You see a lot of them. So kind of whatever is going on kind of gets it's like the reflection through water. It gets bent and changed according to how we construct our world. We each construct a certain world. So in some ways, we each constructing a little mandala out of which we're the very important central figure. So the starting point in all the teachings that I know of where Trungpa Rinpoche talked about mandala principles, he said, to understand anything about mandala, we have to understand our confusion. We have to start with our confusion. We have to really explore and inhabit our world fully, the way it is, without trying to fix or change anything. We have to actually move into our world. Are we, you know, I don't like the phrase take ownership, but something like that. Can you actually inhabit your life wholeheartedly, fully, and completely? Can you inhabit your world? Take ownership. There's no samsara, no sense of the world of chaos, confusion, and suffering, then there's no nirvana, no peace. No struggle, no peace. No confusion, no awakening. These are the kind of the themes of these teachings. And he starts right at the beginning with the key aspects, going right back to basic Hinayana teachings of what really are these forces that fuel samsaras, fuel the pain and chaos of ourselves and all those people around us, right? And there's two kind of threads that run through, again, all three yanas and all three stages of the path. One of them is called grasping. Grasping. I'll talk about that. And the other one is called fixation. And they're like, you know, like a married couple in a lot of ways. Grasping and fixation. And as this came up in the talk last night, and this quality of frivolity. And it's interesting to kind of play with contrast, because one of the defining characteristics of the world of confusion, of samsara, is taking things overly seriously, overly heavy-handedly. At the same time, so that's one extreme, and the other extreme is being just frivolous and just frittering away and not really realizing the opportunity you have when you have it, and wasting time and kind of diddling around, I guess you'd say. So I'd like to introduce some of the characters, a cast of characters in building mandalas, but I want to also stress one further thing before starting. And that is, there's at the same time all of this is happening, the idea of samsara, the idea of nirvana, confusion, awakening. There's kind of a primordial ground that is always referenced in the way these teachings are approached. There's the idea of a primordial, naturally arising wisdom, a primordial, natural arising wisdom that has nothing to do with samsara or nirvana particularly. So all of the kind of drama we're going to talk about in terms of samsaric mandala, nirvanic mandala, and mandala principle at different levels is kind of, I don't know, so we're kind of resting on an underlying assumption of effortless opening and compassionate wisdom mind. It's not produced and we can't make it happen and we also can't get rid of it. So you could say the Vajrayana teachings are very positive in that sense. At the same time, they're very uncompromising and looking at the way we mess with that and taint that original pure arising. So it's important to have that perspective. The phrase I liked about that is it's called the hijacking of primordial intelligence by ego. It's hijacked. Who is the hijacker? It is each of us, the hijacker. No one else can hijack our intelligence. Only we can. So today I'm exploring a little bit on that side. And we have handouts, which you might can look at if you want, as we go along. You might have noticed outside the shrine room, there is a picture, and it's called the Wheel of Life. If you go to Asia, you'll see that outside every single shrine room, you will see the Wheel of Life. Not in the shrine room, outside the shrine room, as a reminder as you come into the shrine room. And the idea of that, the image of that, is it's a picture of samsara. And it contains within it lots of teachings about how we basically moment by moment in an ongoing kind of way create and recreate and recreate and recreate and recreate samsara. Every day, if we don't keep at it, we don't know what will happen. What would we do without it? It has that sense of can't live without you kind of quality. So those would not be hung inside, they hung outside. They're also, a thing about mandala principle is very much about space and form, directions and boundaries, and energy patterns. So by noticing, which I hope you do from now on, noticing you're going past this Wheel of Life when you enter, it's marking a boundary. And you're making a commitment when you enter into this room. And also you're expressing kind of an opening, a heart opening as you enter the room. You're saying, this is what it's about. That's a samsara, that's suffering, that's confusion, that's chaos. And this room represents the opposite of that, represents awakened mind, represents compassionate heart. And so there's a sense of noticing contrast. You know, we're going to be talking about samsara and nirvana as inseparable, but they cannot understand that unless you see how very, very, very different they are. Then you can see at some point how they're the same. So it is really different, the world of struggle and samsara and the world of peace and opening. It's called nirvana. So marking boundaries is a great practice. Actually noticing when you enter and when you leave. And if you begin to have that kind of perception and more ingrained, you will use it in other situations and not just coming into shrine rooms or a special place like this, but you'll notice the transitions in your life. So these mandala teachings are very much connected with teachings on transitions in life. In the same way, chants are marking of transitions. When you start the morning chants, you're marking a transition. I'm actually entering and proclaiming. And at the dusk, you're marking a transition. Many traditional cultures are very tuned in to the energies of different times of the day. And they know what to say, what to do, what's appropriate in the morning, the afternoon, and the evening. So a lot of this teachings, there'll be words and there'll be concepts, but it's about tuning in a certain way, in a different way than we usually do, because there's so much to think about, so many projects to do, so many, you know, problems to solve and relationships to maintain and nurture, etc. But there's a whole other world happening, and that's the mandala principle. There's a whole world happening that we mostly miss. We don't tune in to the qualities of things. We don't notice what's really going on a lot of the time. We're preoccupied. Maybe that's one thing, defining of samsara. We preoccupied. Meanwhile, our life goes by, preoccupied. So that's one benefit of sitting, of course. We actually take a supposed break from being preoccupied, or see how preoccupied we really are and how scared we are of not being preoccupied. So that goes back to quality of space, which we'll be exploring. So these are very fundamental, important things. So if you look at your wheel of life, it's so interesting. It's actually called the wheel of arising, coming into life. You might notice it's being held by a demonic-looking figure, in the mouth of that figure. That figure is Yama. Yama represents death. So it said that the world of habit of samsaric habit is a deadly cycle, basically. It's a deadly cycle. It's held within the jaws of death. You could say it's a living in a kind of unfresh, unspontaneous, compassionate way. So again, Yama is holding the wheel of samsara, but he's somewhere too. So he's within the vast space of self-arising wisdom. You just can't see that. It's behind, there. And then there's that. Yeah. Okay. So the first term it's important to know is called klesha. Many of you already know that, so consider this a review. But klesha, it just means a painful or conflicted kind of emotional energies. And they're in the samsaric mandala, they're at the center. You could say they're kind of the hub or the spring, out of which these three energies flow. And this picture is kind of hard to read, but there are three animals in there. There's a pig, a snake, and a rooster. If you look closely, you kind of see there. And those represent three primary kind of impulsive tendencies we have. The pig represents denial or ignorance, not in the sense of being uneducated or dumb, but in the sense of not being willing to look, kind of covering over kind of energy, or kind of a vaguing out kind of energy. Ignorance, not just not wanting to deal with anything unpleasant, so therefore just bury it all somehow. That kind of quality of ignorance. It's one of our fundamental kleshas or strategies. So sometimes we don't want to be bothered. But the other energy, a rooster, represented by a rooster, is grasping or kind of wanting to pull things in and hold on to them. A grabby mind. And each of these has many different levels, but for instance, this rooster energy, and hopefully not insulting these animals, sorry. But the rooster energy, the grabby energy, happens at a very, very, so quickly and so subtly. The sense perception comes in, and it doesn't just come floating in, but we grab it. Something happens, we want to hold it, We want to pull in everything, people, popularity, money, power, whatever it is. We want to hold it, draw it in, and before someone else gets it. And the third of these central kleshi energies is a snake, and that is the energy of rejection or hatred, desire to, or desire, I mean, the feeling of wanting to destroy, push away. So in a very simple form, the center of this wheel is either pulling in, pushing away, or ignoring. Pulling in, pushing away, or ignoring. And I know some of you, this is going to be so old hat to hear this yet again. But I always suggest kind of looking at your experience. Or even in the session of sitting meditation, for instance. These are always there. That's the notion. They're always kind of lurking there, just looking for opportunities. Like, what, can I make something happen? Can I stop something from happening? Maybe I'll just zone out, and then just eventually someone will ring the gong. Thank heavens, you know. Or I have a little experience. I think, wow, I gotta remember that. Hold on to that, you know. Or I'm such a screw up. Or I failed. I can't, you know. I gotta rid of those. This is not supposed to be the way experience is happening, you know. So it's kind of a interesting mix, and it's something again. As a good practice, a lot of this week, I think, emphasis on meditation and action and looking at perception. One of those aspects is seeing these three energies. You know, not just as something while you learn it on a chart, but exploring it as actual experience. So that is all on the grasping side. And they're elaborated into further kleshas, which we can talk about more later. On the fixation side, the partner side of that is the sense of ego grasping, sense of holding to a strong sense of an independent, separate self. And it's kind of works together almost, I don't know, geologically or something. You know, there's a sense of if you think of a vast open field and you put a fence across it, like a snow field or something, you put a fence across it and you're on one side of the fence. All of these sort of spring simultaneously. You've chosen a side, you've identified with it, and then you have this fence and you have to figure out whether you need to protect your side of the field, whether you want to expand it, get a little bit larger section of the field, or what you're going to do with it. When you set this dualistic pattern up, it fuels a kind of a thoughtless struggle. It's hard not to always be struggling one way or the other, struggling with our experience. So one thing, another good thing to be exploring here is noticing struggling, how much struggle we have with everything. You know, a lot of times when great teachers talk about meditation practice, they say the main thing is relaxing. Easier said than done. You can't say relax, you know, that makes everyone totally uptight. But you can do the opposite. You can notice struggling. This is a world of struggle. Having something to defend or hold on to and having lots of juice behind it through the power of the emotional patterning. And then, in looking at this pattern, around the next ring going outward, you'll see it's divided in 1, 2, 3, 4, it's not really clear, but 6 slices, 6 slices around. And you'll be able to see it more clearly if you look at the big picture outside. But that takes those energies in the center. It's like put them on steroids in a way. So each of the main kleshas, or emotional energies, begins to color. It goes beyond just I'm angry today, or I'm grabby tomorrow, or I'm angry this minute, or grabby that minute. But depending on kind of your pattern, your tendency, your particular personality and history, whatever, those simple emotional energies begin to color your entire world, so that you see, you kind of disown responsibility for the arising of these kleshas, and you perceive them as just responding to what's outside. So you're not dealing with your annoyance, but you have someone outside to blame for your annoyance. Or you're not dealing with your grasping, but it's the fault of those things that obviously need to be grasped. You know, who wouldn't, you know? So there's a projecting of a small emotional patterning into whole worlds. So some people, for instance, see the world as an angry world. Is it an angry world or not? I'm not going to answer, but another person in the same next to them might see the world as just filled with greed. Or a world concretely passionate, passion world. So these are called realms of experience. And they're presented in a lot of different ways in terms of imagery. And they're said to be the realms, the world or environments we create, inhabit, and circle around within. We create worlds and we move in, which is, of course, going to be something we explore that whole notion in terms of mandala further. But the worlds we are said to inhabit in terms of samsara, we start with human. They're called realms. The first is human realm. Human realm is said to be marked by passion, the world of passion. Seems pretty obvious, a world of passion. And also the world of passion, of a certain kind of passion. It's not that you should be passionate in a positive way. Obviously, passion is a good thing. But if this is a sense of poverty mentality kind of passion. So the sense of passion in terms of trying to fill up a gnawing sense of loneliness or emptiness or lostness, a little bit lost, and thinking, you know, if we just find the right thing, bring it in, we'll feel a little less of that pain. We'll be less lonely, less lost, a little bit more solid or secure. So the second realm I talk about is the jealous God realm. I'm just going to the upper half of the three of the six realms. They're called the higher realms. One is called jealous God realm. The picture of the human realm is usually a person with a begging bowl, expressing that sense of incompleteness, wanting. A lot of passion is about trying to complete something that feels incomplete. So on the other side is something called the jealous God realm, and that's portrayed by figures in armor, wearing armor and carrying weapons and stuff like that. And that realm is the kind of expression of envy and competitiveness, and the sense of always looking out for who's one step ahead of you and looking back for who's coming up on your heels as though you're in a race. And you have to be kind of paranoid about, you know, are you going to make it? You know, are you going to succeed? Are you going to fail? You could say that's an obsession, you know, that highly competitive, highly ambitious, but never satisfied, never happy. You can never be happy. You can never be successful enough. You never can. It's just because someone, you know, younger, stronger, better is going to overtake you. You know, that's just the way it is. So it's kind of another realm of suffering. So they both have a sense of there's never enough. Nobody can express enough love back to me. I can never be successful enough, you know. And then the third realm of the upper realms is God realm. The God realm is called. So a lot of people will say, oh, God realm, that sounds great. I want to move in there. The other one's not so hot. Maybe that one's better. But remember, these are all within samsara. So it's an interesting twist in Buddhism that the God realm is considered, you know, part of the wheel of confusion. So that's kind of a shock if you think about it in terms of how people usually think. So the God realm is marked by ignorance, a form of ignorance. Interesting, huh? You know, if we've had grasping, passion, envy, and this is a kind of ignorance. And that is ignoring of suffering around. So it creates its own kind of paranoia. The God realm, you can be really happy and really in a, you know, very blessed with great circumstances. You know, you're handsome, you're wealthy, you know, popular and all that kind of stuff. And as long as you don't think too much about anyone else around you, then you can pull it off for a while. I think of it as a gated community kind of thing. Within my community, everything is beautiful. The lawn is mowed, the flowers are blooming, you know, air conditioner is working. And, you know, I'm kind of nervous ever going out and leaving that, you know, and to the so-called real world, you know. It's very cozy. And it's said to be the realm that's the least compassion in a way. You know, you don't... It's interesting, too, because there's been studies of people how people respond to, like, you know, there's some kind of accident or someone, you know, needs help on the side of the road or this or that. And there seems to be a little bit less tendency to help from the wealthy than from poor. Yeah. I notice that when I go to Whole Food and people just like roar through there and run right over you to get their food. You go to, you know, cheapo store, so people are nicer. That's just what I think. So there's three more realms. These are called the lower realms, and they make a very complete world. One of them is called the Hungry Ghost, Realm of the Hungry Ghost. The Hungry Ghosts are traditional Asian imagery of beings with gigantic stomachs the size of mountains and throats the size of a needle. And the image, obviously, of greed. You can never get enough. Kind of the glutton imagery. Feeding. But nothing can get in, really. So in some ways, if the human realm, just trying to gather friends and lovers and supporters, and here you're just trying to get stuff. You get enough things, enough food, enough rugs, enough couches, enough whatever, then things will be okay. But again, it becomes an endless cycle, never satisfied. All of these, never satisfied, that's basic. And all of them are struggle, and all of them are fueled by kind of frivolity. Another one, the animal realm, usually depicted by animals. Yeah, there's one, you can see an animal down there. And you get a prize, you find the animal. And the animal realm, again, not an offense to animals, it's just an image. The animal realm, like the God realm, is characterized by a kind of ignorance, a different kind of ignorance. The ignorance of the God realm is kind of infused with a prideful quality. You know, I've got it all, and the reason you don't is because you're all losers. Losers. Dead. So there's that kind of ignorance. In the animal realm, the quality of the ignorance is more of a stolid, uninterested quality. Very habitual and without much curiosity or sharpness of mind is the image, a certain kind of willing to kind of be blurry and vague and not really dig into much, get a superficial understanding and just sort of stop there. There's a certain kind of lazy quality and a certain kind of a stolid quality. And once you figure out the way things are done, then that's the way things are done. And people could tell you a million things about why it should be done otherwise, and you wouldn't change it. You know, because that's the way things are done. That's the way we've always done them, you know, that kind of quality. It's interesting. I've been reading this history of medicine and the critique of the medical system. And they're talking about from when a discovery was made, for instance, that you should wash your hands to avoid an infection, and to when that became adopted as a practice was like 40 years. And she gave example after example of breakthroughs that would literally save lives in medicine. But this habitual, this is the way things are done, now don't look further, mind is so powerful that it was shocking, you know, someone would discover something and it just go, years would go by before any changes. Well, sometimes we notice things about ourselves like that. And years go by. And we thought, oh, I could have done that. And now I'm 90 years old. Maybe I'll do it. And there's one last realm, which is the hell realm. And one would think that's not good, and it isn't. And that's the realm that is connected with anger and kind of desire to, I mean, with the tendency to destroy. So it's not, you know, it's sometimes described as a world of aggression, but it's really, the word as I understand it is much more than just being, you know, a little bit aggressive, but it's powerful aggression that would cause one to kill or to maim, or to destroy. So that tendency in us creates this realm of hell, which is seeing the world as out to get us big time, and a sense of real claustrophobia, fear, feeling like we're cornered by life. Yeah. So I hope you don't mind going slowly and systematically through all these that you've heard many times. But they never seem to not be relevant to me anyway. The other thing is that, you know, you could say from the Hinayana perspective, we're just seeing these different patterns and how they arise. It's really a combination, you know, the klesha energy, the energy of the emotional obstructions, and joined. When that energy is joined with a fixation, with a fixating on a self, this is what we create. We create these worlds. So on one hand, they're psychological experiences, and some may be more familiar to you than others, and they said we kind of, depending on who you are, and you rotate around in various ways. But you could also think of them from the Mahayana perspective as different realms that require compassion, because we see other people also create these realms, and we create them literally. There are people in war zones, hell realms. There are people starving in hungry ghost realms. There are lonely old people in the human realm, so isolated and alone, you know. There are people so caught up in the, the rat race to get ahead. They can never stop, and they're trapped, you know, in this relentless demand to, you know, do one thing and the next thing and the next thing and get ahead. There are people like that. Which one to leave out? Oh, jealous God, human. Did I only leave out God? And there are people, you know, who are just shut off by ignorance. And then there's people who are just so benighted, you know, they're so privileged, they're so God-realmy, that they're just going to have a clue what's really going on in the world. And they don't want to. And they make it very, invest a lot not to see what's going on. So, and that's not to blame people. That's to arouse a compassion for people and situations they're in, and arouse compassion for the kind of worlds we create on within us, right? But to begin with, we got to figure out, you know, these basic energies, how to deal with them. The energies of self and energies of emotions. Do we go to 12:15? Oops. Okay. Well, let's go a little further. And in your reading, you can read a lot of this. So I'm not going to talk about everything, obviously. But just to know, the outer ring around the outside is really describing what's called karma, the activities that are generated within samsara. And so samsara, to work, it needs kleshas, it needs egomania, it needs actions, you know, and we build the samsaric world, you know, like good little workers in that way. So only one last point, so there'll be a little bit of time for discussion. I'll try to keep my other talks shorter. But I think it's important, again, these patterns, these energies, all of these things, every single one comes up in different ways in discussion of mandala. And all of these patterns are those which Trungpa Rinpoche talked to as experiencing fully the way they are, experiencing fully the way they are, really inhabiting samsara, you know, in order to be able to transmute. You can't do it from a distance. You have to go right into it. That is what is said in terms of the ground of the mandala. So the only other complementary thing, which is going to come up, and I'll just touch on it because I can't go into that much detail, but the arising of the kleshas and also the arising of a sense of separate self, that kind of pairing, that would be also a good thing to explore in your perception. Where does your sense of self arise? How does that arise? Not as a puzzle, but just to notice when is it most obvious, your sense of me, you know, sense of me. Traditionally, it's talked about, again, very precisely, looking at perception. How do we perceive anything? through the senses, including the mental sense. We have sensations, physical. You know, we have sounds, we have sights, we have thoughts, we have all that. But that's not the self yet. That's just a bunch of sensations. But then something happens, becomes you. And that's described as a kind of a certain point. All those, you know, beautiful, you know, colors and patterns and sensations and feelings. And then it's just like a big clamp. Then it's your opinion, your thoughts, your sense, your things, your body, your every, you know, and other arises, you and other. And then the drama goes on. It doesn't just have three acts either. It just has, it's like going to this drama that never ends, and you have to keep buying tickets. And it gets more and more expensive. Kind of like that. So understanding that is important, and it comes up in some of the readings as well. It's called the rising of consciousness and the conflicted consciousness, the grasping onto our experience, basically. Grasping onto experience, making it as solid as we can, and then defending it. So this is, it said, the world we need to inhabit, there's no other place we're going to build mandalas, which is building the sense of sacredness in awakened heart, mind. It's going to be built right here within these kind of very fairly messy sounding situation. And that's the basic starting point for today. So there's time for a couple questions.
Good morning, still. I would like to know more about how to work with these while we practice and outside of the shrine room. Is it just a matter of noticing as they come up and labeling them, or what are your suggestions?
I'm suggesting, at least between now and tomorrow's talk, to a number of things. If you get a chance, looking at the picture outside of the Wheel of Life, noticing, paying attention, entering and leaving spaces, entering here or leaving there, and then noticing the noticing the kind of qualities and colors and sensations of things with curiosity. You might notice what draws your mind one place or another. You might notice the arising of the kind of response or opinion or judging, and see if you can see those points where experience gets held. Noticing any attempt to try to make experience go one way or the other. So I guess the main thing would be paying attention to the quality of struggle, where it's very subtle or more obvious. You know, we might have a struggle with a different person, but maybe a very subtle struggle, moment by moment on the cushion in one of the... Notice the quality of struggle that is so pretty much imbues experience of samsara throughout, to the extent that I don't think anyone ever really relaxes. You know, we can talk about relaxing. We sit around and have a glass of wine or something. Not here. But it's still a struggle. And what are we struggling with? Why? That's what we're looking into. We're looking at really basic things. Is it possible not to be like that? or should we struggle to not be like that? And then we're stuck. So it's important to look at these things because they affect everything. You know. So anyway, just be curious. No big deal. Yeah. Yeah.
My first thought was that we inflict some of these things on ourselves with karma.
With what?
Karma.
Karma? What's that? What do you mean by that?
Do we inflict some of these realms and places and stuff? Maybe it's all up.
Well, the question is whether we inflict these things by means of karma. And in the context of this wheel of life, karma just means activity. So we activate, you know, like first you have a bad feeling about someone and then you activate that feeling by telling them off. And then they have a response to that and they're suddenly in a bad mood and they talk to the next person and yada, yada, yada. You know, it's a contagion of confusion. But, I mean, it's really talking, when you look at the outer ring, it's saying similar things. It's talking about the arising of a sense of self from the perceptions of the world and the coloring of the world through powerful emotions, which for the most part just toss us around like, leaves in the wind or dust in the wind. In fact, that's one thing. I will say one more thing about that. One point, Vidyadhara said that one great thing about sitting meditation is it's taking a break from doing anything. You're not creating so much karma. You're not, you know, all your struggles, you're holding them to yourself and you're not bothering anyone else and causing these chain reaction things, you know.
I was curious about the role of memory in all of this. It's sort of not mentioned much. I can imagine that in some ways it would build the concepts that sort of skew or change your perception of things. But it's also it's something we have. It seems to be a part of it, and I'm not sure where it fits in.
It arises as a thought. And then we think, oh, I remember that, so I must be that person. I remember, you know, being a child, and I remember, you know, going on this adventure, and I remember, you know, this and that. And a lot of times, sometimes that may have happened, may not have happened. The memory, the same thing, keeps changing over time. And someone tells you a story, and then you think that happened to you and remember it as you did it, but they did it. There's a very tricky memory. But the main thing is it arises as a thought. And it gives us the illusion that we can hold on to things that are no longer there. We think we can kind of, you know, like a big, you know, like a red wagon, but then we can drag it along and it's still there and that's, you know. But there's no way. I mean, you're not the same as you were even 10 years ago. And we can think about what we were like, but we don't really know anymore, necessarily. Who knows what it was like when you were 3 years old, right? When you were there, you owned it, you know, you were there. And now you're somewhere else. I am assuming you're older than three.
Just by a couple of years, yeah.
That's because I'm so insightful.
Hi, I'm Nate. I found it really interesting when you were talking about the three animals in the center of the wheel. Because I'm a storyteller, and I was thinking about how in folk tales in all kinds of different cultures, there's a whole, you know, you hear a lot about listening to the animals and respecting the animals and how usually, you know, if people in the stories don't listen to the animals, they get into a lot of trouble. So it just it just made me think about, you know, in Vajrayana, in the Buddhist path, is there a notion that the animal realm is like a literal physical realm that it's unfortunate to be incarnated into because of the ignorance that it's associated with? Or is it more, are they more purely images that describe a psychological experience? And is there actually also another side of it that describes the importance of respecting and listening to animals as well?
It's both. At least in my understanding, that on the one hand, they're images, you know, you could be honestly, they're somewhat insulting image to roosters and pigs. Hopefully they not hear in the talk and they don't hear us, you know. But, and there is a sense of, within the realms, the traditional understanding is that, guess what, we're humans are the best realm. But not best in the sense of superior to other realms. Not in that sense at all. But in the sense of being a realm where it said there's the most discontent. And that makes us able and drawn to Dharma, teachings of awakening. You know? So that's one side. So there is a sense of literal realms, and there's also a sense of psychological realms, and there is a sense of upper, higher, and lower, but again, these are all within, they're equal in the sense that they're all slices of the pie of samsaric wheel. At the same time, in many other texts in the Buddhist tradition are incredibly respectful of animals and of the natural world. And there's many beautiful paintings and poetry and descriptions of being the value of being in the wild and natural world. You know, some of the great poets and adepts, you know, lived in the forest and under the trees and et cetera, like that. So there's tremendous sense of that. And in fact, at one point, this actually, I think it was in the Mandala principle in the three yanas when I was looking at that. Trungpa Rinpoche was also talking about plants. And, you know, we should think about plants and their feelings. You know, that, so we went even beyond animals because they were discussing, you know, vegetarianism and eating meat and whatnot. And he said, plants want to live too. You know, so what about them? Which is interesting because almost all the science about plants and their communication and they have brains at the end of their roots and things like that. So it's both. There's definitely a general, I would say, anthropomorphism bias, you know, humans being humans, a little bit think verso so special. But I would say that's not the point of the teachings, though. They really are just all, you know, higher or lower, they're all equally parts of this, you know, in this scheme. And this is just the starting point. But it's saying, seeing those qualities. And animals really do suffer. And humans really do suffer. And, you know, all these beings obviously suffer. That's the point. Yeah.
Judy, my thought about all of what you're talking about seems that what gets locked out somehow is compassion. And it seems to me that what we struggle with is when we bring all of our stuff with us every time we go anywhere. And when we sit, we kind of gradually open and get more sensitive, more compassionate to ourselves. Why does compassion get locked out with the human experience? What of our experience? Like, it seems that it's all kind of originated at some kind of, you know, loss of some sensitive compassion towards the experience. Like, that if we are caught up in anything, any of those experiences, that the process of practice, for example, would be to go deeply into where we're at and then try to be gentle with ourselves about it. how does compassion get locked out in our experience anyway, you know?
How does it happen?
Yeah.
That's a great question. I don't think it ever gets totally locked out, actually.
It gets lost.
I think it gets blocked, for sure. And I think mostly because of our own preoccupation, you know, with our own selves and our own dramas. And then other people kind of fade, other beings kind of fade into the background more. And I think it's, you know, when there's this image of kind of a raw quality. Mm. And so it's not always bring ourselves to feel that, you know, because it's a certain kind of so tender. Mm-hmm. And there's a force of compassion is so strong. And it'll be one of the themes going through this. But in some ways, the first step symbolized by this iconography is almost a kind of ruthlessness. At first, we have to get real and stop pretending we're all these wonderful, compassionate, egoless, kind of saintly beings. You have to get real and say, okay, actually look and be a little more ruthless. And that's a form of compassion, too. Because unless we take that look, we can't ever relax with ourselves. So naturally, we're going to feed these patterns over and over again.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay, I think it's speaking of feeding, feeding cycles or whatever. I think it's time for lunch. So I'd like to just, I guess we should have handouts. I'd like to dedicate the merit for those. I never like to do things that some people know and others don't. So let's just do it in an informal way. Just think about what you're doing. Bring yourself back to whatever inspired you to come here. Bring yourself back to anything that you've learned or have a value so far. And make some kind of aspiration or to actually bring it out with you and help other people in as many ways as you can to share what you've learned and by your presence make a difference in the world. So we'll call that a dedication of merit. Everyone can do so.